following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Without freedom of the press, no democratic form of government could exist.
We switch you now to London.
I'm standing on a rooftop, looking out over London.
Good night, and good luck.
Good evening from our CBS newsroom in New York.
NBC presents Chet Huntley and David Brinkley.
From ABC, this is World News Tonight. With Peter Jennings in London, Max Robinson in Chicago, and from our desk in Washington, Frank Rendell.
Good evening.
This historic legislation, the telecommunications law, will create many, many high wage jobs, will create opportunity and better lives for all Americans.
When the press is free, the people of a country are free. When the press is not free, the people of a country are in danger of slavery.
Keeping you informed with information, news, and the views of people making the news. It's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Well, welcome to a Thursday. I am Nicole Sandler, coming to you live at NicoleSandler.com by the magic of digital audio delay on the Progressive Voices Network, now heard 6 to 7 p.m. Eastern, Tuesday through Friday evenings on Progressive Voices. You know, I used to run a bunch of different show opens, some more humorous than others. And lately, if you've been listening, you hear I always use that one about freedom of the press because it is so important and it is one of the last vestiges we have of this democracy. And it just, with each passing day, it seems like more and more of our freedoms are being taken away from us. Today, I happened to listen to a little bit of Sarah Sanders' press briefing from the Oval Office. And luckily for me, I guess I missed the beginning of it because it started with, there were two video screens in the room, one on either side of the podium. And apparently they beamed in the president. Yes, Dump himself, issuing from the descriptions that I read, yelling at the gathered reporters there about the benefits of the tax scam plan that Congress passed before they went out on their Christmas holidays. And the point was made over and over again on Twitter by journalists and us regular folk alike, that the president was probably sitting 150 feet or maybe yards from where that podium stood. But he had to do this on video because he can't get up in front of the press and take questions like any normal president has in the past. We're coming up on a year that he's been in office and 11 months since he's done an actual press conference. Now, I know when he leaves the White House and goes on Marine One to go fly off to one of his golf properties somewhere, usually down here in Florida or, you know, when it's warm out in New Jersey or somewhere else, he'll take a few shouted questions from the press gathered around the lawn there at the White House. But that's when he can conveniently, you know, pretend that he doesn't hear the question or just answer what he wants to hear. These are the most lying group of thieves that I think have ever been in the White House. And Richard Nixon was a pretty good liar himself. But I don't think anyone approaches aptitude of lying that Donald Trump and his minions have mastered. Stephen Colbert hit on something last night.
First of all, Mr. Trump, you should be bragging about the size of your missile. Okay?
Yeah.
Buttons. I didn't know if he knows this. Traditionally, buttons are kind of a lady part.
You think?
As in, I don't think the president knows where to find the button.
Ah.
Oh. Plus, I hope not. Don't know what that means. Plus, interesting fact about the nuclear button.
Yeah.
There is no button.
No button.
It's not real. It's just a metaphor. Unless they put a phony button on Trump's desk, right between the one that orders him a Diet Coke And the one he presses to hear what the cow says. Stupid cow. Fake moose. Now, obviously, a very joke. Obviously, thank you. Thank you. Obviously, we're kidding, and we kid because we don't want to die. Meanwhile, Republicans have been silent about this. Nothing about the risk of thermonuclear response. I think there might be a way, though. I really do think there might be a way to calm Trump down about the size of his button. This is a message for the president. President Obama. Sir, you've given a lot for this country, but we need one more thing. We need you to go on national TV and say that Donald Trump's penis is bigger than yours.
That's all it would say.
No one will believe you, but only one person has to.
Yep.
For the love of God, sir, what choice do we have?
Yeah, there is no choice. That would do the trick, because it is, everything is done for an audience of one these days. I got to say, regarding, you know, Donald Trump's preoccupation with the size of things, I saw a great tweet yesterday from God. God has a Twitter account. It's at the tweet of God. And he tweeted, "I cannot understate how small at real Donald Trump's penis is." To which I replied, he reminds us of that all the time. And somebody who I guess is puts him or herself out there as a progressive on Twitter says to me, "Really? This is civil discourse by liberals?" And then some other nonsense that doesn't make any sense to me. And my response there, one last thing before I block this person, I said, try getting a sense of humor. It's really necessary these days. Now, I have a hard time joking about a lot of stuff that this guy does because it's so deadly serious. I mean, think about just what he's done so far today. Aside from backtracking on his scathing statement about Steve Bannon yesterday, because Steve Bannon said something nice about him on a radio show last night. Seriously, this is what Bannon said on a radio show last night.
President of the United States is a great man. You know, I support him day in and day out, whether going through the country, giving the Trump miracle speech or on the show or on the website. So I don't think you have to worry about that. But I appreciate the kind words.
And so he was asked about that today in one of those press pool sprays.
Did Steve Bannon betray you, Mr. President?
Thank you.
Any words about Steve Bannon?
I don't know. He called me a great man last night. So, you know, he obviously changed his tune pretty quick. All right. Thank you all very much.
That's all it takes for him. You say something nice about him and that's all it takes. But apparently that's not all it takes. Trump is threatening a lawsuit against not only Steve Bannon for the things he was quoted as saying in this book. But remember, Steve Bannon didn't write this book. The book was written by Michael Wolff. He's also threatening a libel suit against Michael Wolff and the publisher if they go ahead with publishing this book, which is supposed to be out on Tuesday. Apparently, it's already number one in pre-orders on Amazon and all that. Aside from that stuff, Trump did a lot of harmful things today, Trump and his administration. One is, guess what? They proposed opening up nearly all federal waters for oil and gas drilling, giving the energy industry access to fields in the Pacific and Atlantic Oceans and the Eastern Gulf of Mexico that have been off limits for decades. The criminal that's the governor of Florida, Rick Scott, already spoke out against this. But this is just unbelievable. So he did that. Jeff Sessions today announced his new policy to roll back Obama's unofficial policy of not enforcing federal cannabis laws in states where it's legal. I gotta love Colorado Senate Dems, who on their official Twitter account tweeted out, "We'll give Jeff Sessions our legal pot when he pries it from our warm, extremely interesting to look at hands." Yeah. There was other bad news today. Remember last week we talked about, was it last week or the week before? Before the vacation. Virginia, the House of Delegates, where it was tied And then some Republican official found another ballot that was miraculously a Republican ballot. And so the votes in this one last race were tied, 11,608 votes for each. And they were going to do a drawing, a random drawing between the two names. Well, they held the drawing this morning. And shocker, the Republican's name was picked. Yep. Now, the Democrat, Shelley Simons, isn't conceding yet. She says she's still considering another recount. And and I told you this when we heard that they were going to pick a name at random, that the recount was an option, another recount for whoever came out the loser in this drawing. So that's still up in the air. It's just another day of stomachs being in knots everywhere. And wondering, when are the Democrats going to come out and do something to give us confidence? I came across an article, and we'll talk about it because we have the author of this article joining us on the show today, Nathan J. Robinson, who's the editor-in-chief of Current Affairs Magazine, and a pretty smart guy from what I can glean, will join us as our guest today. Howie Klein is on vacation this week. He'll be back next Thursday. But first, before we get to any of that, let's check out what's news.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Washington and the rest of the nation was rattled Wednesday as the first excerpt of a new book written by Michael Wolff, Fire and Fury Inside the Trump White House, was published in advance of Tuesday's official release.
Wolff's account is based on 200 interviews and more than a dozen visits to the White House complex. One of his key sources was dismissed chief strategist Steve Bannon. Among the most damaging revelations are ones like this about Russia and that infamous Trump Tower meeting with Russian lobbyists. Quote, the three senior guys in the campaign thought it was a good idea to meet with a foreign government inside Trump Tower in the conference room on the 25th floor with no lawyers. They didn't have any lawyers. Even if you thought this was not treasonous, unpatriotic, or bad bleep, and I happen to think it's all of that, you should have called the FBI immediately. And this one about potential financial crimes. Quote, you realize where this is going. This is all about money laundering. Mueller chose senior prosecutor Andrew Weissman first, and he is a money laundering guy. Their path to bleep Trump goes right through Paul Manafort, Don Jr., and Jared Kushner. It's as plain as a hair on your face. The president responding with a lengthy statement suggesting that Steve Bannon was less important than he would have people believe and that he's crazy. Quote, Steve Bannon has nothing to do with me or my presidency. When he was fired, he not only lost his job, he lost his mind. Steve was a staffer who worked for me after I'd already won the nomination by defeating 17 candidates, often described as the most talented field ever assembled in the Republican Party. Steve pretends to be at war with the media, which he calls the opposition party, yet he spent his time at the White House leaking false information to the media to make himself seem far more important than he was. It is the only thing he does well. Steve was rarely in a one-on-one meeting with me and only pretends to have had influence to fool a few people with no access and no clue, whom he helped write phony books.
The book dominated Wednesday's White House press briefing, the first one since the Christmas break.
The president says that when Steve Bannon was fired, he not only lost his job, he lost his mind. Does he feel betrayed by Steve Bannon? Does he regret hiring him?
I think the president's statement is extremely clear what his position on Mr. Bannon is. It was pretty lengthy and pretty detailed, and there's not really much to clarify or to add.
But is there regret there? I mean, he says a lot in this book, and they did have a long and close working relationship. So is there a sense of betrayal?
Once again, I think the president's statement fully addresses what his position and what his relationship with Mr. Bannon is.
Did the president's son, Donald Trump Jr., commit treason?
I think that is a ridiculous accusation and one that I'm pretty sure we've addressed many times from here before. And if that's in reference to comments made by Mr. Bannon, I'd refer you back to the ones that he made previously on 60 Minutes, where he called the collusion with Russia about this president a total farce.
And the president's statement suggests that Steve Bannon had very little influence in the White House, but the president himself elevated him to the same level as the chief of staff and put him on the National Security Council. How do you reconcile that?
I wouldn't say that he elevated him to the same level of the chief of staff, and I think that in the actions that Steve took, the president was clear that it didn't have a lot of influence on him or the decision-making process throughout his time here at the White House.
It continued like that, with Sarah Sanders pushing back on the allegations. A second excerpt released Thursday describes a scene where, at Mar-a-Lago just before the new year, quote, a heavily made-up Trump failed to recognize a succession of old friends. Continues. It used to be inside of 30 minutes he'd repeat word for word and expression for expression the same three stories. Now it was within 10 minutes. Indeed, many of his tweets were the product of his repetitions. He just couldn't stop saying something. Although the major news organizations were quick to point out that they had not independently verified the claims made in the book, Trump's attorneys sent a cease and desist order to Steve Bannon to prevent him from making disparaging comments about the president and his family. ABC News reporting that a statement issued late Wednesday said that Bannon had been notified, quote, his actions of communicating with author Michael Wolff regarding an upcoming book give rise to numerous legal claims, including defamation by libel and slander, and breach of his written confidentiality and non-disparagement agreement. Another cease and desist letter was sent Thursday morning to Wolf and book publisher Henry Holt, demanding that they stop publication and issue an apology to the president for defamatory statements made thus far. In other news, and there is other news, the president on Wednesday announced that he's disbanding the controversial Presidential Advisory Commission on Election Integrity, allegedly formed to study voter fraud, that was chaired and led by Vice President Mike Pence and Kansas Secretary of State Kris Kobach. Trump created the commission last year in response to his ridiculous claim that he lost the popular vote to Hillary Clinton because of millions of illegally cast ballots. And just as recreational cannabis becomes legal in California, the Associated Press is reporting that Attorney General Jeff Sessions is rescinding the Obama-era policy that discouraged enforcement of federal laws in states that had legalized it, potentially paving the way for the federal government to crack down on the burgeoning marijuana industry. And that's a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is 100% listener supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com/donate. All right. For a bit more of what's going on in the news, we check in with our friends at the Talk Media News Service. They're at TalkMediaNews.com. On the line today is Doug Christian. Hey, Doug. Doug? And I think I'm having phone problems today. Doug Christian, can you hear me? Oh, no. That's not good.
I can hear you now.
There you are. Hey,
Doug. Through? good.
There you are. You scared me for a moment there.
Yeah. I was like, whew. Yeah. Oh, anyway, what a day. These first few days of 2018 are exhausting. It feels like we've already gone through a year's worth of news.
Yes, I mean, by all rights, the Trump first term should be over by now, because it's like Trump years in the White House are sort of like dog years in human life.
Yeah, I feel like
right?
a dog.
Yeah,
7 years of it is. It's identical. I mean, this is insane, and of course, everyone is talking about the book. I mean, that is the kind of the talk of the town, and. Of course, I mean, it sounds, I mean, there are a lot of reporting that he could have been somewhat sloppy with his reporting, which is too bad, because there's no doubt that so much of what he's saying is true.
Right.
I mean, it on so many different levels.
And there's some of it that's been corroborated. So it is sad that some of it is allegedly sloppy, because it's giving the White House, freedom to sort of discount the entire thing when a lot of it has been corroborated. One of the, I believe the part owner of the Hollywood Reporter, backed up a conversation that allegedly was held at Michael Wolff's house. I think it featured either Roger Ailes or Rupert Murdoch or somebody. It was a private conversation, but she said she was there and he got it right.
Yeah, I mean, he's a very good writer. I mean, mm-hmm. he really knows how to scribe, and it is. I think that this White House is going to look for every little nook and cranny that they can find to discount the entire thing, and I'm scared about that, and I'm fearful that if that were to happen, that so many terrible things that this White House is doing could get swept under the rug as Trump says fake news.
Right. Here's that part.
I'm very fearful of that.
Here's that that corroboration. Janice Min is the name, or she's a part owner of The Hollywood Reporter. And she writes, so I was one of the six guests at the Bannon Ailes dinner party in January 2017. And every word I've seen from the book about it is absolutely accurate. It was an astonishing night. So,
wow.
Again, little bits and pieces are being corroborated. And I guess yesterday the White House released some visitor logs that just proved that Michael Wolff had access to the White House on a number of occasions during the time that he was talking to people at this book, and pretty much unfettered access, which Sarah Sanders lied about today in her press briefing. This woman lies as easily as her boss does.
It's astonishing. It is absolutely astonishing to watch her. There is not one pause. Halt for just a moment. She just plows on through. I've never seen anything like it. It's terrible. It's just terrible to watch. I mean, one other aspect of this book, which is very interesting, of course, is that Rebecca Mercer, who is one of the funders of Breitbart, and also has been a backer, and her husband Mercer has been a funder.
It's actually her father. Her father. Not her husband.
Oh, her father. That's right. Yeah. That's right. Her father. Yes. Thanks. And now she is threatening to cut off Steve Bannon and Breitbart.
Yeah.
If he doesn't turn around and play the game.
It's amazing.
So it's going to be very interesting. Yeah, it is. And of course, that's exactly the same reason why so many people in Congress, even though they know what's going on, are looking the other way, because they are looking at their donors. They're looking at the tax cuts. They're looking at what they can do. And so they're willing to basically risk the survival of the world for this person.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what happens, because the Mercers, they fund Breitbart. And Sarah Huckabee Sanders from the podium today suggested that Breitbart fire Steve Bannon. The things that these people do are just so unconscionable. You know, they've proposed firing NFL players. Now, the yep. editor of a fake news organization, you know, the wow. stuff they do is beyond comprehension. There was other.
Oh, it sure is.
More unpopular news today, as I hinted at in What's News. The Trump administration is proposing a massive expansion of offshore drilling on all places. I mean, I live in South Florida. I live along the coast. And
yeah. And that includes Florida. Yes,
that's right.
They're going to go after Florida.
Yeah, they're going to go after all of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
The Pacific.
Yeah. It's unbelievable. I mean, this is astonishing. I mean, it is. Wow. It takes your breath away, because I don't even know. I have no words to describe just how horrible this is. It looks like they're just plowing right full speed ahead on this. It's not like we are that we need this oil either. I mean, A, the world is suffering from global warming.
Yep.
B, we've got plenty of natural gas from fracking that's already causing terrible environmental hazards. Why this is being done? It's obviously to appeal to Rex Tillerson's former boss.
Right. Here from Reuters.
Yeah.
The Interior Department identified 47 potential lease sales compared with 11 under former President Obama's strategy, making it, quote, the largest number of lease sales in U.S. history offered in a federal five-year offshore drilling plan. Now, of all times, it makes no sense. The same way that Jeff Sessions going after states where marijuana is legal, now something that he distinctly said he wasn't going to do during his confirmation hearings. He said that they would let state law rule, basically. Now he's going back on that message. It seems like they're just pulling out the most unpopular policies and putting them in action.
It's amazing. I mean, also, there's a distinct irony in Jeff Sessions revoking legalization of marijuana, considering he's a states' rights guy. He's named Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III, and because, of course, after two Confederate generals, and the whole so his whole DNA is states' rights. But here he wants the feds to override state legislation on this.
Right. And of course, this comes just mere 4 days after recreational pot is legal in California. And California is expecting a huge tax boom from it because, you know, this cannabis will be taxed. It's been great for Colorado. Cory Gardner, I think, is his name, the senator from Colorado, Republican, said, quote, I will be putting today a hold on every single nomination from the Department of Justice until Attorney General Jeff Sessions lives up to the commitment that he made to me regarding legalized marijuana in Colorado. Yeah, you've got senators and congressmen in some of these states now who are nervous, and rightly so, when very unpopular policies are being put through.
Well, and also another piece about this is that this also is why why the cartels existed, is because there was a ban, marijuana was illegal, and so cartels made tons of money and killed a lot of people. It was terrible, and yet this, by legalizing marijuana, it gave tax revenue to the states,
yep.
And B, it got rid of the cartels. This is the best news for the cartels that Jeff Sessions could give them.
Yep. Definitely agree.
Yeah.
I definitely agree.
Which means that he is not really for law and order. He's about something else.
I don't know what he's about. Meanwhile, though, there's been a lot of criticism from both sides of the aisle on this new announcement today from Sessions. So we'll see what happens with that. Obviously, Big Pharma doesn't want legal marijuana. I think they like medical marijuana because they figure they can get in on it, but they don't like the recreational stuff.
That's exactly right. Big Pharma has really had a hold on all sorts of medicinal uses or drugs. For instance, one example is that there has been evidence to show that just minute amounts of lithium in water, which is an element of drug, is an element but is used in larger quantities for bipolar disease, just a minute amount actually reduces the suicide rate in the population by about 40%. It's just amazing. And yet Big Pharma legislates and will not allow such a thing to happen, which is, I mean, it's like not allowing fluoride in the water for teeth. Same thing.
Any more news on North Korea? Because all this puts Trump's tweet of the day before about his button being bigger than Kim Jong-un's button, it's sort of out of the top of mind, and that's the most dangerous thing that's happened so far this week, this year.
It's probably the most dangerous thing that has happened in the last 5 years, because the North Korean leadership will strike back very hard at Kim if they see him as weak to Trump's taunt. And so Trump's taunt means something to this dictatorial regime. And of course, North Korean, they just reportedly had a missile test fail and crash into one of its own cities. So they are kind of feeling on the spot right now about any kind of perception that they are not as strong as they are trying to be. This is a very scary time because, I mean, Trump has no idea, none about negotiating, about trying diplomacy or anything. But it is great how South Korea and North Korea are now talking about getting the North in the Olympics. That is a good sign.
Yep.
Because it, yeah.
Yeah. All right.
Because it means, yeah.
Doug Christian from the Talk Media News Service at talkmedianews.com. Thank you so much and Happy New Year.
You too. Thanks, Nicole.
All right. I'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
You bet. Bye.
All right. We'll get more news tomorrow. That's the thing about what's going on now. There's never a shortage, is there? We'll take a quick break and come back and talk about the problem with the Democrats. I know that's something we usually talk with Howie Klein about on Thursdays. Howie's not here today, but I have someone who I think will fill his shoes. All right. So stick around. It's Nicole Sandler Show at NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
These are the sounds of crushed souls. The sounds of despair from former radio personalities languishing in the purgatory of corporate consolidation. These former radio personalities have lost their livelihoods, not because they weren't entertaining or informative, but because they don't meet today's corporate terrestrial broadcast standards of being smelly, overweight douchebags, seething with vein-popping hatred. These radio refugees and their audiences have since migrated to the internet, but their struggle continues as the quest for monetization ensues. Nicole Sandler is leading the way to reestablishing thought-provoking and entertaining radio. And you can help by clicking the donate button on NicoleSandler.com. Donate today, or as much and as often as you can. Dry the tears of listeners by removing the rotting stench of corporate radio. Won't you help?
All right. Well, I'm trying to call our guest, but it appears he has not turned on his Skype. So I need to dial the phone number. Bear with me while I do this. This is working without a producer. Okay. Ah. Okay. Ah, there he, I just got a thing from him saying, can you try that again? So let's try that again. I hate when I do this. All right, let's try it one more time and see if this will work. We'll see. If not, I will. Hello? Nathan?
Yes. Hi.
Hi. Ah, Nathan Robinson is here. Let me tell you a little story.
Okay.
I only recently discovered Current Affairs magazine and your writing, Nathan Robinson, via a listserv that I'm on where someone posted this article titled Just When You Thought Democrats Couldn't Get Any More Oblivious. And it spoke to me. And so after I read that, I read a few more of your pieces up at currentaffairs.org and thought I need to get this guy on the show. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you very much for having me. Appreciate it. It's an honor.
Before we get to that article, let's talk a little bit about who you are, because you just started this magazine, Current Affairs, a few years ago as both an online entity and a print magazine. That's pretty gutsy in today's media climate, isn't it?
It is, yes. Every single person told us that was a terrible idea, that print media is doomed and that we were going to fail. But it's actually gone surprisingly well so far. We're 2 years old now. We've got a few thousand subscribers around the country and around the world. And we've just gotten to the point where we now have a physical office, and I'm working for it full time. So it's actually worked out quite well. The thing is, The gamble that we had was, I believe that if you put out a print magazine that is really beautiful and is a really nice object, you could get people to subscribe. And so we put a lot of work into the sort of graphic design, into making it a really nice product. And I think so far it's paying off.
And you don't have any advertising, so you're supported by subscriptions and I guess donations.
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, that's part of the appeal, right, is that if you get our magazine, you're not getting a big book of ads like a lot of magazines were. Because with the old magazines, there was no real reason not to just read the content online. So we're doing a kind of different thing to what a magazine used to be, which is now it's something that's ad-free, and it really exists as a kind of nice physical product that you want to have on your coffee table.
All right. And once again, you can get most of the content, I guess, at currentaffairs.org. But it's a bi-monthly, right? It comes out every 2 months?
Every other month, 6 per year.
And so currentaffairs.org is the website. You're on Twitter at @curraffairs. So people can follow you there. I noticed that you use that Twitter handle more than your own personal Twitter handle.
Yeah, I don't really tweet. I try and avoid it. I try and think to myself, every moment I'm spending on Twitter is a moment I'm not spending working on the magazine or writing, and so that has enabled me to curtail my Twitter habits, even though it's very tempting to tweet all the time.
Twitter is a convenient habit, especially in this weird news cycle that we're in, where it seems like every 5 minutes, every time you turn around, there's something else going on. But I do get the appeal of staying away from it because it's frustrating as well.
Yeah.
Before we get to the piece that I originally wanted to talk to you about, though, we should talk about another article that you have up at on the website, Why I Love Mark Zuckerberg and Can Never Say a Word Against Him. Kind of tongue in cheek, I'm guessing.
Yeah, a little bit. I have said various words against Mark Zuckerberg in the past. I probably will continue to in the future. But that headline is about sort of the role of Facebook, not only in people's lives, but in the lives of independent media institutions like Current Affairs, and just how dependent we have become. Even though, you know, we operate on our own, we're supported by subscribers, we're still very dependent on Facebook to channel traffic to us. Mm-hmm. And so we kind of have to stay on their good side in a certain way.
Right. And there lies the problem with the word of maybe the decade, algorithms. If you piss off the wrong person at Facebook and they make a little adjustment to their algorithms, all of a sudden, maybe your content doesn't show up in as many places as it would have. And there go clicks and eyeballs and people who otherwise might not see an article that you wrote, and you lose a potential subscriber.
Yeah, and it's not just, I mean, you know, when you say the fear of, you know, angering someone or pissing someone off, you know, that seems less realistic. I mean, certainly that could happen. But the thing that actually does tend to happen, a very realistic fear, is that you get caught up in some tweak to the algorithms. And this happened to, I cite an example of a progressive show on YouTube where YouTube was trying to filter out hate speech, but because the algorithms are always imperfect, they swept up this progressive radio show, mm-hmm. and they saw a massive drop overnight in the number of viewers that they were getting. And because they were so dependent on ad revenue, it totally changes the situation for you instantaneously if you just so happen to fall on the wrong side of whatever the formula is for determining whether you're going to show up on someone's page.
Yes. And it's happened to me, too, I think in smaller numbers. But, you know, sure enough, some of my revenue is all, we're all listener supported here. And some revenue comes in via YouTube. But now I've noticed that more and more of my videos, they deem not relevant to the audience, or therefore they won't monetize certain videos because whatever they've found about the subject matter, they think that for whatever reason, they can't monetize those videos. There's something at play here, and it may not be a human being, but something in the coding that says we don't like what you're saying, so you're going to get less money from us now.
And there's no way to find out what it is. There's no appeals process. There's no transparency at all. So you're left just sort of guessing. And for a small independent outlet, it can be really difficult. Because we, I'm sure you're the same as us in that we are on a shoestring budget, mm-hmm. right? Yes. We are surviving basically month to month. We depend on the money that comes in. We depend on our ability to forecast our future revenue. And so when there are sudden changes in it, it can really threaten the whole institution, the whole enterprise.
Right. And again, it's a private company. It's not like you can appeal the decision. And in many cases, it's not like you can ever find a human being to even talk to about it to get your questions right. answered.
No, definitely. Definitely. You're at their mercy completely.
Yeah. So anyway, hopefully the algorithm gods will stay on the side of current affairs.
Gosh, I hope so.
Yes, and the Nicole Sandler Show. Anyway, we're speaking with Nathan J. Robinson, who is the editor-in-chief of Current Affairs Magazine at currentaffairs.org. And again, I mentioned I'm on a listserv, and somebody posted a link to one of your articles just when you thought Democrats couldn't get any more oblivious. And I read it, and we are at such a weird time in history. We are looking at a president who is, I think, certifiably insane. The fact that he made it into office just goes to show how horrendous the Democrats were in putting Hillary Clinton up as the candidate. Now, I'm not here to be a Hillary Clinton hater or a basher, but we had the two worst candidates for president in my lifetime. And we've had some pretty bad ones in my lifetime. I guess more people voted against Hillary Clinton than voted against Donald Trump, or in the states that made the difference to put it over the top for the Electoral College, because Hillary Clinton actually got 3 million more votes in the popular vote. But I do fault the Democrats for not letting the primary process play out fairly. Because if it had, I mean, I don't have a crystal ball, but I think Bernie Sanders would have stood a really good chance of winning.
Well, all the polls that we have suggest that that's true, right? The polls at the time suggested that if Bernie Sanders went up against Donald Trump, he would beat him by a substantial margin. Hillary Clinton was much closer. And looking back on it, all of the polls show that Bernie Sanders would have beaten Donald Trump. And also, when people are asked favorable ratings for politicians, he has the highest favorable rating of any politician in the country.
Yep.
There's a lot that you can fault for the outcome of the election, though. I mean, there's the nomination of Hillary Clinton in the first place, but then there's actual strategic decisions that were made during that campaign, because even with her as the candidate, that was still a winnable election. As you said, she won the popular vote, so things could have been done if you just shifted resources into the states that mattered. So it was first a sort of a problem on a number of dimensions. It was a problem of the failure to put forth a compelling candidate, the failure to put forth a clear platform, mm-hmm. and the failure to have a good electoral strategy for actually getting people in the right states to go to the polls. So there are a number of things we can fault them on for 2016.
Most definitely. And now here we are at the beginning of 2018, and this is an election year. And I hate it when I keep hearing people talking about November, November, November. This is 2018. There's going to be a year of primaries. Primaries do not get enough attention in this country, because I think primaries are really important to get us the candidates that we can get excited about in November. One of the reasons I think oftentimes in midterms, especially Democratic turnout is so low, is because Democrats tend to put up pretty terrible candidates. And you talk about this phenomenon in your article you cite another article from Politico by Bill Scherer, somebody who I know, who's basically advocating for the generic Democrat.
He's literally advocating for the generic. I mean, the article is called "The Case for a Generic Democrat."
Yeah, and he cites Tim Kaine as what? That's his ideal candidate?
I think that's kind of stunning that you would actually sort of embrace mediocrity and being uninspiring, because I tend to think of this as a flaw in the Democratic Party rather than a virtue. His argument, though, is that, I mean, he's basically taking to an extreme an argument that is very familiar. I mean, I don't think many people would say what Bill Scheer says, but I think there's a lot of thinking that runs along similar lines, which is, well, our job is just to be moderate, restrained, and reasonable, and the Republicans will be crazy, and we'll stand up next to them, and we'll look reasonable, and they'll look crazy, and everyone will vote for us. The problem is that every single time they try this, from John Kerry to Hillary Clinton to John Ossoff in Georgia, it mm-hmm. doesn't actually work, because if people aren't inspired, they don't get out of bed and go to vote for you.
Right. You know, the only time it did work was just a couple of weeks ago in Alabama, where Doug Jones won. But, right. you know, it was a child molester he was up against, right?
Right. And it barely worked.
And barely, by the skin of his teeth. And if it weren't for the African-American population who came out and voted in droves, we would have Senator Roy Moore, which is just unthinkable.
So I think it's a very dangerous strategy to rely on people being so horrified by the other side that they will vote for you. Because Doug Jones, I mean, it could have gone the other way, even with Roy Moore as an opponent. And that really suggests that you've got to have something more than just a D next to your name, no matter how outrageous or far to the right the Republican candidate is.
You're so right. Nathan J. Robinson is with us, and today is Thursday, and usually on Thursdays, Howie Klein of Down With Tyranny is my regular guest. I don't know if you're familiar with Howie or not, but he runs the Blue America PAC, and as such, they look for the best progressive candidates, and it seems almost every week without fail, he's telling me a story about how either the DCCC or the DSCC is picking the worst possible candidate to go up in a certain race. For instance, let's look at Arizona for a moment, where we have Jeff Flake, who's retiring because he sees what a monstrosity Trump is, but he rather than staying and fighting against him, he's like, oh, I'm not going to run for re-election because I know I can't win. So there's an empty seat there, and something that could be picked up by the Democrats. Who are the Democrats pushing? Kyrsten Sinema, who has the worst record from progressive push in Congress. She votes with the Republicans 90-some-odd% of the time. Rather than find a progressive, somebody that people will be excited about, they're going for the Republican light. And this seems to be the strategy that the oblivious strategy that the Democrats employ, isn't it?
Yeah, it's so true. They go for it over and over. And the way I think about it is, look, if people wanted a Republican, they'd vote for the Republican. Mm-hmm. I mean, you really have to provide a contrast, because if you don't provide a contrast, if it's two people who are both saying essentially the same thing up there, which is they're giving the Republican Party line, we're going to cut your taxes and reduce the size of government. They're going to go for the Republican. Voters are going to go for the Republican because the Republican seems more honest about it. The Democrats never seem quite committed to that because they don't really believe it, because they're Democrats. So people tend to want to prefer an honest Republican to a waffling Democrat. It kind of seems to be the lesson to come out a lot of these races. Now, it's not always true. I mean, Ralph Northam won in Virginia, and he was kind of uninspiring. So, I mean, you know, there is evidence on both sides, but I figure, like, the other part of it is that it's not just a strategic calculation. It's also a moral calculation, which is, if you're a Democrat, you're supposed to stand, you're supposed to have beliefs. You're in politics because you have a sincere set of commitments and policy preferences. So if you're just going to be a Republican light, what are you even in politics for? We have to provide a contrast because we actually do believe in different things, and we need to sell the public on our values, not just get people with D's next to their name elected, because that doesn't do anything if they aren't sincerely committed to the things progressives are committed to.
That's why I talk about how important primaries are. And again, the Democratic Party seems who should be removed from primaries. They should let the candidates battle it out, be there to provide support for anybody who's going to run as a Democrat, but not take sides and certainly not push a particular candidate over others, and thereby giving us a choice for a Bernie Sanders in November, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I think that should be the lesson that comes out of 2016. And to some degree, that the people at the top of the party have caught on a little bit to this. I mean, you can see from the fact that Donna Brazile is now embracing Bernie Sanders and throwing Hillary Clinton under the bus, and that, you know, Chuck Schumer's getting photo ops with Bernie Sanders and talking about the economy a lot more. You can see that there's kind of a sense that if they don't embrace kind of that the progressive platform, they're not going to get anywhere. But at the same time, you have to be fully committed to that, because what did they do after 2016? They immediately elected Tom Perez as the head of the DNC. Yep. I thought the Ellison Perez fight for the chairmanship was very instructive, because Keith Ellison was an example of one of these people who is who inspires a lot of young people, who can really get out the vote. But everyone at the top of the party, even Barack Obama, pulled all of the strings they could, used whatever leverage they had to get Tom Perez into the position. And what's been the result? Well, we don't really hear much from Tom Perez because he's a pretty uninspiring bureaucrat.
Right. Right. He goes on TV. He even tries to say the right things, but their actions betray them, by the way that in a recent meeting of the Rules Committee, they let go most of the Bernie Sanders people and they kept the Perez people. The Democratic obliviousness, you say, is harming the party's electoral fortunes. I agree. But you also cite in the article the fact that millennials are overwhelmingly liberal, but they're not Democrats. What?
Yeah.
So what do we do about this? Because,
it's a real squandered opportunity, right? Because I actually think that Democrats could do really well right now. I mean, obviously, with Donald Trump in office, you have the perfect foil. And young people despise Donald Trump because they're the ones who are victimized by the inequality that Donald Trump and his billionaire friends are trying to perpetuate. So it should be a great opportunity for the Democratic Party, but the Democratic Party's popularity among millennials is very, very low, and yet they're all socialists. So that to me suggests that there's something going terribly wrong here. They're more liberal than ever, but they're not voting for the left party. But it's a real opportunity. And what I also think that the Democrats do have what it takes in a certain sense, in that they have a really great party platform. The Sanders people were very influential in putting together the official Democratic Party platform, and it's actually a pretty impressive document. I mean, it calls for a lot of, you know, massive new infrastructure spending, raising the minimum wage to $15. It's a really sort of aggressively progressive document. And if the Democratic Party would stand behind it, right, and would come out and endorse those principles full-throatedly, instead of doing what Nancy Pelosi did when she was when a young millennial socialist talked to her at a forum and said, well, how are you going to speak to us, we democratic socialists who want to support the party? And she replied, well, we're a capitalist party. Well, that's not a way to get those people on your side. And the kind of disgust and hatred that I hear among people at my age for the Democrats, I worry about it, because I actually support the Democratic Party. I want it to succeed. I don't think third parties are a very viable option.
Not and now. So
It frustrates me to see this failure, because I do actually think there's a real opportunity here. I'm not a cynic. I don't believe that the Democratic Party is irredeemably corrupt. I think they have a good platform and they need to run on it.
Do you think that we need a change in leadership? Because you mentioned Nancy Pelosi, who, you know, most speakers of the House, once they lose the gavel, they then go home and you know, turn it over to somebody else. The problem is in leadership, we've got a lot of people who are of that ilk, who are of the, and I'm doing air quotes around moderate, you know, they're conservadems. Yeah. They're not progressives. They like to use the word progressive, but they don't actually act like progressives. They don't think like progressives, and they're not giving us the progressive values that have been proving to be so popular.
Well, you know, Nancy Pelosi's very liberal, right? I mean, she's from San Francisco. She's
been
a liberal's liberal. But I think the problem is that the theory behind Nancy Pelosi leading the House Democrats has been proven false, right? She was asked why she thought she made a good leader. And she said, well, people like me because I'm a really good fundraiser. And it's true. Uh-huh. She's actually incredible at bringing money into the party. She's a very good fundraiser. And that's been the theory for why she stays at the top. It's not that she's good at inspiring people. It's not that she's good with the grassroots. It's that she brings in the money. And I think we saw in the John Ossoff race why that theory is failed, right? Because the Democrats plowed $25 million into that race and they lost it. And so I think that should signal that we need to reject the theory that says those who can bring in the donors need to be in charge of the party. And we need to try something new, which is those who are most in touch with the people we need to bring into the party need to lead the party.
Right. Instead, you know, when people say over and over again, give us something to vote for, not just to vote against, we get a better deal by way of a slogan, which, you know, is not going to really do the thing. I guess the slogan worked for Trump, but Make America Great Again, I guess, worked better than a better deal, which sounds like a pizza ad.
Oh, well, yeah, the better deal thing is a step in the right direction, right? Because if you go on the Senate Democrats' better deal website, I mean, actually, a Washington Post writer, Dave Weigel, just criticized my article today because he said, well, the Democrats, you say the Democrats don't stand for things. Well, they do stand for things. They've got this big better deal platform. And if you look at it, it's true. They have a lot of things they want to do. I actually don't think it's that they don't have ideas. I think it's that they aren't I think it's a huge messaging problem because they aren't willing to really embrace it and really get behind it and really figure out how to sell this better deal to the American people and how to make it seem like more of a slogan. I mean, right. The way they are approaching it almost uniformly among the elected Democrats is to just see it as, oh, well, the lesson of 2016 is we need to say the word jobs more because right. We need to be populist, and being populist means saying the word jobs. So now they say the word jobs. But I think they have to understand that it's more than that. It's telling people exactly what you're going to do, telling it to them in very clear language, and staying on message, not getting distracted by all the Russia investigations, not getting distracted by whatever's going on in the Trump White House today, whether he's having a spat with Steve Bannon, but staying on message all the time, trying to explain exactly what you want to do and exactly why you think people should kick the Republicans out of office in November.
Right. But it is hard not to get distracted by the drama in the White House. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that you have a book, Nathan. You're coming up on the year anniversary of Trump, Anatomy of a Monstrosity. That you came out with right around Inauguration Day. Has he lived up to everything you thought he would?
Well, I mean, I actually tried in that book not to make too many predictions because I thought it was hard to tell what kind of president he'd be because he has a tendency to defy expectations. Won the primary. Nobody thought he could win the general election. Then he won the general election. I have to say his presidency has not been particularly surprising since Trump has been very much himself. I think one of the things, the main takeaway that I have from the Trump presidency is that there are sort of, we kind of need to think of it as both incompetent and competent, in that he's definitely incompetent in a lot of ways, in that he gets into needless feuds. There's a lot of staff turnover. He couldn't pass the Affordable Care Act repeal. But he's startlingly competent in that he's set out to kind of destroy the executive branch and is doing a fairly good job of that. If you look at all the regulations that have been repealed, it's quite frightening. If you look at the changes in the administrative agencies, New York Magazine just had a list of the 55 ways that Trump has changed the country over the course of his first year in office. And there's a lot of really significant stuff, from rolling back environmental regulations mm-hmm. to gutting the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau to all of the changes in immigration policy. So I think the main thing, that my main assessment of Trump after a year, is the kind of the same as I had in the book, which is, in the book I was trying to get people to think of Trump both as, people think of Trump as stupid, and I wanted them to think of him as stupid but not stupid, right? He's smart right. in a certain way, but not in all ways.
Right.
He's a very
right.
ignorant man, but he's also a very cunning man. He's kind of like a con man. A con man isn't necessarily
exactly.
book smart.
Yeah.
But a con man can trick you and swindle you out of your money.
Yeah, and he's proven himself to be exactly that. He is Don the Con. Nathan J. Robinson of Current Affairs Magazine, thank you so much. It was a pleasure talking with you. You've got a new fan here. I will be checking out your work at currentaffairs.org. We can follow it at Twitter, at Cur Affairs. And hopefully you'll come back and join us another time.
Thank you so much, Nicole. I loved it.
All right. Bye-bye. Take care.
Bye.
Thanks. All right, Nathan J. Robinson. That was an interesting conversation. I'll post a link to the article on the blog at NicoleSandler.com. And with that, we're done. We'll do it again tomorrow to wrap up the week.